You're listening to The Zeitgeist, a podcast focused on Germany, the United States, and the transatlantic relationship. Join us as we discuss economics, trade and technology, politics, security, and a lot more. I'm Jeff Rathke, president of the American-German Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome everyone to this episode of The Zeitgeist. I'm really delighted that we can welcome Christian Odendahl today. Christian, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I've also got Peter Rashish here, the vice president and director of our geoeconomics program. Morning, Peter.
Morning.
We are talking on April the 5th, Friday, and Christian, you may know, is the European economics editor at The Economist. And for those who haven't seen it, he has a recent long read on the triple shock facing Europe's economy. I think we'll touch on some of your views in the course of this conversation. But Christian, if I could start maybe just to open, I guess you'd feel it makes a difference for the European economy who wins the American presidential election. Is that a safe assumption?
Yeah, that's a safe assumption. And then the easy answer there is yes. There's a bit of a joke in Europe that sort of there are two huge elections happening this year. One is highly consequential for Europe, and the other is the European Parliament election. And I think that's a bit unfair to the European Parliament, but I think it just goes to show how important the US is economically, politically, in terms of Europe security and so forth. And in economic terms, well, the European economy is already in quite a troubling, long-lasting slump. And the last thing it needs is sort of further protectionism from the US and an escalating trade war between the US and China. So I think it's fair to say that the US presidential election matters hugely to Europe.
And so you're referencing, of course, Donald Trump's proposals for a 10% across-the-board tariff, essentially. You mentioned a trade war with China. We will get into that, I think. Do you consider that as likely as a 10% tariff in the event of a Donald Trump election, or simply the risk of it is enough to cause concern?
I think the risk of it is already enough to cause concern. And I think sort of a across-the-board 10% tariff, I think, is probably something that the Europeans could live with. But I think it's the question is how will American politicians from the Republican Party join sort of the economic policy issues with national security issues, with the U.S. stance on Russia, with the U.S. geopolitical conflict with China and so forth. So I think the Europeans are worried about a much broader set of repercussions. Repercussions, which economic repercussions could be, of course, one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We look, of course, very often here at the German economy as part of the single market and the European Union's international economic engagement. Do you think the German economic model is going to be able to transform itself in this new kind of harsher global economic reality? There's been a lot of talk about it. And of course, Germany has transitioned away from Russian hydrocarbons, but that's only part of the challenge it faces. Where do you see the things headed when you look at Europe's largest economy in Germany?
So I think for Germany, that the current challenges are sort of a bit of a perfect storm, right? You have a very export-oriented economic model in a world of geopolitical tension and protectionism, right, that will struggle anyway. Germany is one of the most hard hit when it comes to demographic change. And unless it can compensate for that with huge amounts of immigration, there will be an economic drag. And then you have an industrial economy with quite a sizable chunk of energy intensive industries that is already facing the challenge of how to decarbonize that, and now had the additional shock of being cut off from Russian gas for political reasons, and they're, you know, transforming an economy that is, and I think that's the crucial aspect here. I mean, transforming an economy that is used to being successful, I think that is one of the underappreciated aspects of this. There's not that much willingness in Germany to really reform and transform this economic model. And I think that is because this economic model has served Germany so well and has led to record numbers of employment. It has led to huge fiscal surpluses for the German state and so forth. And sort of, I think it's sort of parting ways with the old ways. I think that is the most difficult part. And this is where the German policymakers struggle, where also German businesses struggle to some extent, and where we will see a extended period of restructuring. So the German economy will go through this process for years to come. But I'm still fairly optimistic that the model is itself can adapt to this. It's not that the German economy is unable to adapt to this, I think. But the let's say the Merkel years were sort of the golden period for the German economy. And what is shocking, I think, to many in Germany itself is how little the country has prepared in good times for this fairly predictable transition. Although, you know, nobody could predict that this will all come sort of at the same time.
Christian, if I could go back to the electoral calendar, there are the elections as well for the European Parliament, and as we've been discussing, the German economic model and German economy function within the broader EU single market. What's your sense of what might change with a new European Parliament and a new European Commission in the fall? Do you think that the there'll be a shift of emphasis?
So I think for Europe, there has to be a shift of emphasis. Already, the last commission wanted to be more geopolitical, but it didn't probably quite expect how much geopolitical it would have to become. And now, with the whole national security and defense dimension, there will have to be a fairly, you know, deep discussion about what it is that Europe stands for, what it is that the European Union should pay for and focus on. But this is probably as much one for the European Parliament, the Commission, as it is for national governments to decide, if not more. And we see the fairly acrimonious relationship between Germany and France playing out at the moment, showing how deep the rift is even between two of the closest partners within the EU. Let alone some other countries in the EU. And so this is not a the European Parliament is just one aspect and one part of this reset of the EU towards being a truly more geopolitical actor. And the French and others are pushing quite hard already for sort of further common European debt to finance defense spending and so forth. These are the kinds of discussions that we will be getting starting with the European Parliament election.
So we might finally have that geopolitical commission in a prospective second von der Leyen term, it sounds like. Do you think there'll be a shift, or it'll be more of a both and? What I mean is, you know, will there be more attention to kind of where economics meets national security, you know, and some of the things that the commission is focused on the first, you know, during this, let's call it the first von der Leyen term? Or do you think it'll be kind of, you know, one thing might crowd out the other? In other words, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's for political reasons because of the constellation in the commission and the parliament, or for other reasons, do you think that means that, say, the green transition and climate policies will, you know, will find themselves kind of down a rank if security is, you know, moved up? And, you know, then I just also wonder, what about kind of hardy perennials like finishing the single market and the capital markets union? Is there any, you know, room for, that something like that might be approached?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the idea that Europe's economy needs some kind of revamp, there's a sort of common view, but it's absolutely unclear what that means in practice and sort of to what extent you can build political momentum behind a further deepening of the single market, for example, right? So the Capital Markets Union is something, if I now started to talk about this, right, all your listeners will probably drop out, and so I don't want to do that. But this also shows sort of that for the for politicians, it's really hard to build some kind of political coalition behind, you know, further deepening of the capital markets union. And this is just one example. There are many, many, many similar ones where the tedious long-term work of completing the single market in services, in digital, in data, in capital markets, and so forth, is really hard. And then you have the simple solutions, which are sort of big subsidy programs, protectionism, you name it, right? Mm-hmm. So these are the things where you can much more easily build a coalition around. When it comes to the geopolitical stuff, I mean, Europe is really badly placed for playing this right? Because national security is a national competence. And so you would need, and for good reason, probably. And so you will need to have 27 countries find some kind of common ground. And whenever I talk to people in the economic security sphere here in Europe, they very often come to quote the example of Japan and sort of, this is what we should be doing, right? We are not the United States. But we should find a way of sharpening our tools. But that should go along the lines of Japan. But then when you talk to experts on Japan, they say, well, the biggest asset probably Japan has in terms of economic security is that the whole political spectrum and business and so forth have sort of a unity of purpose, right? A unity of purpose of what it is that the Japanese want to achieve. And this is exactly where this whole thing then breaks down, because there's not a unity of purpose within the EU of 27. It's really hard to come to a conclusion on any of these issues. And so the sharpening of these tools and implementing these tools, I think we will see sort of gradual further implementation of this. But I don't think we should expect sort of drastic changes unless sort of a major crisis happens. But this is, Europe was not built for, you know, being a strong geopolitical and geoeconomic actor, and it needs to build the competences and the tools and so forth to be able to play this right. And this will be one of the central themes of the next commission, but it's not that I expect sort of revolutionary change from year one.
But and you know, is it going to be more effective for the EU to try to do that head on or by sort of camouflaging those efforts? What I mean is that one of the reasons that I, you know, you do hear people saying we still need to do that capital markets, you know, risking our listenership, as I say it. But, you know, we still need to do that because without the capital markets union, we won't be able to finance a green transition. Without the capital markets union, we're not going to have big players in the digital and tech arena the way the U.S., you know, has them. So, I mean, is it by stealth, or do you think that it's going to be more effective to approach those kind of issues head on?
So I think, as I said, the heads-on one is the one where people turn off the podcast. So, you know, hiding it somewhere in the issues of the green transition or defense or technology and so forth is probably the way to go. And this is what policymakers are already trying. Sort of, we need to find sort of European solutions in tech and AI and so forth. But for that, we need sort of deeper pools of capital and so forth. So we will see these kinds of attempts. I'm not sure it will be an easy sell. And the process is very, very, very tedious, right? So at the risk of boring your listeners, but think about harmonizing the insolvency processes of 27 countries, right? That alone sounds like a decade's work. And this is probably where many politicians will say, well, do we really have to do this? Because you get in all kinds of trouble in sort of your national debate. And so it is a very long-term process, but you're probably right that the fact that we have the green transition, the technological rivalry, the geopolitical rivalry, and so forth, will probably, you know, give politicians the opportunity to craft a story around a more unified single market. But the work, that doesn't make the work less tedious.
Right. So you're sitting in London, I think, if I'm correct. Jeff and I in Washington, and in between is the Atlantic Ocean. And that is being bridged a little bit today because we're in the second day of the meeting of the US-EU Trade and Technology Council, which is meeting in Leuven in Belgium. You know, there is speculation about whether this is the TTC's last installment of the season, or rather the end of the series, sort of depending on what happens with politics in Washington and Brussels and elsewhere. You know, what do you think about the TTC, but also more broadly, what's happened with transatlantic economic relations, say under the Biden administration, and do you think we can expect more continuity, more change, depending on, you know, what happens after the end of this year politically.
So I think it's really important that Europe and the US keep talking about what it is that they expect from the other. I think that is sort of and being informed of where the sensitivities are. I think, you know, generally the first installment of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the subsidies therein of electric vehicles and so forth, was a genuine shock to Europe and other allies. To what extent the Americans sort of pushed forward with a policy that they considered quite discriminatory. So I think to keep talking on these issues and being informed about what the others have in mind, I think is really important. And, you know, even if the TTC is mostly sort of about exchange of views, I think that's really important. But there are political differences between Europe and the US when it comes to how to deal with international trade, how to deal with China, how to deal with export controls of sensitive technology and so forth. That these differences, and I think you could see that quite well with the steel tariffs, right? And sort of trying to resolve that issue, and that the Europeans and the Biden administration failed to solve this. That shows sort of some of the quite fundamental differences that are hard to bridge, right? So the Europeans, when it comes to their carbon price and their carbon border adjustment that is being implemented as we speak, in this sphere, the Europeans have worked for more than a decade on a solution that works for them, that works for 27 within the EU, that works, at least according to the EU, within the rules of the WTO, which is quite important to sort of mid-sized countries who depend on these rules when it comes to dealing with the likes of China and the US. And so for Europe, it's really, really hard to deviate from that path, whereas the Americans have a much more sort of more political, more sort of, you know, powerful way of dealing with these things. If they say, well, let's just try something else, the Europeans will say, sorry, this is, you know, you cannot dismantle sort of a decade or two of work on this just because, you know, you want to limit steel imports from China and you would like us to do the same. And so, you know, there are fundamental differences. And I think we need to be aware of that and sort of scale down the ambition a bit when it comes to finding really common ground between the EU and the US. I know there are sort of more optimistic people than me on this, that really we have a common purpose and that there are clear ways in which Europe and the US can work together. But I think if we just avoid some of the disasters, I think then we'll have made some progress. And in the meantime, sort of keep talking of where Europe and America can work together hand in hand and where legitimate differences remain.
That's interesting that you say that, because I do think, you know, a number of people would say that the US and the EU have been coming closer together on China, you know, whether that means that the EU has come closer to the US or vice versa. I think lately it's been a little bit of both, I would say. Do you think, and you've said, well, but it sounds like there are limits to that, or limits to how far the EU would go on China. I mean, do you see that those limits is mainly about, you know, when it's a kind of in the economic and trade field to the WTO and, you know, keeping, you know, putting that on a pedestal? Or do you think it has to do with the fact that they're just different interests that the EU and the US have, you know, in terms of their economic and trade relationship with China? You know, which one is, do you think it is, or is it both?
I think it's both. I think that if your economy is a lot more dependent on the global economy, and that's the case with Europe, right? If you sort of add imports and exports as a share of GDP, the EU is sort of twice as involved with the global economy as right. As the American economy. So, and that alone sort of dictates what your interests are, right? Then I think from a security dimension, also the US has much larger ambitions than Europe, and in terms of the overall strategy, there's also a bit of an element that the EU itself is figuring this out as we speak, right? It's not that the EU has a clear idea of what its interests and what its strategy is. And you could see that, for example, from the with the German China strategy, right, which was a which was published last year, which was a very tedious long term process of trying to figure out what Germany's view on China is, and that again was a year long process. Now imagine that to do that in 27 countries and then agree on something, right? So finding a common strategy for Europe is actually quite difficult, right? But there are differences in interest, which I think you can clearly see. And then the EU was built as a sort of rules-based bloc. And so putting the WTO rules, international trade rules, on a pedestal, I think it's the wrong way to frame it, because it is basically the extension of what the EU is. So it's basically part of the EU's very DNA. And so I think these kinds of differences will remain. That the US and Europe increasingly come together on China in part is because the US pushed for that, right? So think of the ASML discussion, so the Dutch maker of chip making equipment, and the US policy on that. That was the point where a fairly small country like the Netherlands had to figure out what are our strategic interests in this, right? And how can we embed this in the European strategy? I mean, this cost that probably took the entire Dutch government a year to figure out. And that was just one company. And so there's some genuine convergence, I think, between the EU and America. But I don't think we should expect a full convergence, because you know, deeply the interests and the way the EU conducts itself internationally is just very different from the US.
Yeah. And so the EU is a kind of wingman of the liberal international order in a way that is not the same for the US, just because of how it was created and how it functions internally.
I think that there is a bit of a reality check here for Europe. I think Europe exactly thought of itself as sort of one of the protectors of the rules-based order, and now realizes that it was largely the US backing for that rule-based order that made sure that it could exist. And it's unclear, I guess, how this will progress after the US election, depending on who wins. But it's clear that the EU will continue to uphold this, also because other small and mid-sized countries in the world depend on that rule order as well, but are not powerful enough to make their voices heard. So I think that you will try to continue to do that, but sort of the reality check, I think, was a bit sobering in Europe, that how much even the EU as a defender of the international trade rules depends on the US to do the same.
And speaking of a rules-based approach and predictability, for maybe a final question, I come back to Germany, where we see, on the one hand, Germany highly dependent and having built its economic model around the multilateralism and, in particular, European integration. But we see recently a certain kind of friction arising, where Germany has been a laggard or even a little bit of a troublemaker when it comes to the approval of the supply chain due diligence directive. That's not the only example, where political difficulties at home have led to Germany being a bit of an outlier at the end of the approval of new measures at the European level. Do you think this is inevitable for the remainder of this coalition and beyond? Do you think this is fundamentally inhibiting the ability of Germany to exert leadership at the European Union level? And is that off the agenda for a while?
I think that's a really, really good question, because all these reform efforts, economic security measures, and so forth are really hard to put into practice if at the same time your domestic economy is weak and your policymakers are sort of deeply divided about how to deal with that. And I think this goes beyond Germany. It's the entire European economy that is currently facing various challenges and have to sort of grapple with geopolitical tensions at the same time. So the regulations at the EU level that you mentioned, that was in part because there was genuine concern of how that will impact a German economy, right? So the supply chain law, for example, But in part, it was just domestic political games interfering with European lawmaking. And that's, of course, a dangerous precedent if the largest economy and one of the anchor countries of the EU starts playing these kinds of political games. I mean, we've had these before, but usually not from the largest two countries, France and Germany, because they were aware that exactly that kind of leadership and commitment and consistency when it comes to EU rulemaking is what is holding this together and making this workable at all with 27. And I'm just waiting for the first instance of a major, you know, country saying, well, the Germans did it too, right?
Yeah.
When they are blocking legislation that they don't like. So I think that Germany set this kind of precedent on multiple occasions, not just one, I think is a really bad example. I think this is sort of, that is something that the German government internally has to figure out beforehand and then be consistent and predictable. Because I think this is part of where Germany lent the whole project a bit of political stability, that even if there were domestic differences between the parties, I think their stance on things like, I don't know, the EU's lawmaking, international security, some basic planks of Germany's national interest, I think there was very little division. And this kind of consistency was what other countries could depend on at the EU level. And I think this really sets a bad precedent.
Oh, and it means that in a way, the European dimension has become maybe not an afterthought, but it is the expendable. It is the place where you can release pressure now in the German political arena. And it's a way you can let off steam if you are, let's say, one member of a coalition, of an unwieldy three-party coalition. So I think you've highlighted an important aspect there. So, and maybe that's where we will wrap for today. Christian, thanks so much for spending the time with us and for offering your view from a European perspective on the trends in the European economy and the issues at stake. We really appreciate the conversation.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me.
This has been Christian Odendahl, the European economics editor at The Economist, and we look forward to having all of our listeners with us on the next episode of The Zeitgeist. Thanks for listening to The Zeitgeist, a podcast produced by the American German Institute at Johns Hopkins University. You may know us under our old name, the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies. Send us your feedback by email at info@aicgs.org or on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where we have new handles at AMGERINST. And also please visit our website at AmericanGerman.institute, formerly AICGS, and we'll look forward to seeing you there. Thanks.